Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
That is exactly what I needed to hear.
Thank God someone here knows what they're talking about.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride.
All right, you need to take the time and get the full pitch.
Oh, yeah, it is the moment you have been waiting for.
Don't get me wrong. I love the ladies. I mean, they rev my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom.
Andy's out. Ryan and Brad are in.
Goodness sake, kid. Keep your voice down. Your father's listening to the radio.
This is the Manny Fry Show.
I was looking into it. Three quarters of these people will see their health care premiums double. Live in states where you won in the last election. I mean, even here in Florida has the highest number of residents on Obamacare in the country.
And I'm saying we can fix it, Nora.
You have helped end these government shutdowns in the past when they came about. And you did it by bringing
them. I'm very good at it. But I'm not going to do it by extortion. I'm not going to do it by being extorted by the Democrats who have lost their way. There's something wrong with these people.
So then what happens on November 15th when the troops don't get a paycheck?
Schumer is a basket case, and he has nothing to lose. He's become, I just left Japan, he's become a kamikaze pilot.
Sounds like it's not going to get solved, the shutdown.
It's going to get solved, yeah. Oh, it's going to get solved.
How?
We'll get it solved. Eventually, they're going to have to vote.
You're saying the Democrats will capitulate.
I think they have to. And if they don't vote, that's their problem. Now, I happen to agree with something else. I think we should do the nuclear option. This is a totally different nuclear, by the way. It's called ending the filibuster.
There will never be another president like Donald Trump. That guy has made news all week for saying, hey, you know what? I think it's time to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, which would make legislation easier to pass for anybody, but right now for Republicans. And he said it in such a way that it was not even the main point of the interview. It wasn't like he came out and said, I have an official statement on this big thing that needs to be addressed. He was just talking with Norm O'Donnell, and we had to play. This is like the third time we've played that clip,
yeah,
because that's where he first said it. I think that was Sunday.
Yep.
And
60 Minutes.
He said that to Norm O'Donnell, and you can hear it's not even really the point of the question. He just sort of gets around to it and says, oh, by the way, That is the product of him doing a ton of media, because you know that he's going to talk to everybody all the time. Every single day we come to the studio here on the Andy Fry Show, noon to three, and we look and see that there's a press conference happening either from Carolyn Leavitt, which is for the White House, or it's from Donald Trump himself.
There was one today.
See, I didn't even know that, and I'm saying this.
Yeah.
So there was one today, apparently, from Donald Trump. Before the show?
Yep, before the show, he was meeting with, was it Uzbekistan?
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's meeting with a lot of the sort of
the
Eastern,
countries.
Yeah.
So, Middle Asia.
Middle Asia. He's doing a lot of foreign policy stuff right now because the government's closed. There's not a whole lot he can do with Congress. He can do stuff with executive action, but he's already done a lot of that. And so he has a conference yesterday where he, again, pretty big news, working with multiple pharmaceutical companies to lower prices on, specifically yesterday, it was about those GLP-1s, those semaglutides. So that's big news. And you probably, unless you're listening very closely, I mean, if you listen to the show, you probably know it. But the vast majority of Americans will not even know that that happened, because there's always so much happening. I guess it's sort of the product of his own making, where when you talk to the media that much, you're so accessible that when you make news, it's like part of the mass of other news, and you don't even really notice that it's happening. But back to this filibuster issue, this has been a big deal this week. It rocks Washington whenever anybody talks about this. And then we've done two polls on it this week alone to see if your opinion has shifted. And spoiler, it kind of didn't. I mean, I don't remember exactly what the turnout of the polls was, but it was split where some people were saying, yeah, get rid of it entirely. So others were saying, yes, get rid of it just for the shutdown, mm-hmm. which is where you and I landed, just because, again, I'm a big budget guy. You have to do something about the budget, and Democrats will not work with you ever on the budget. So if you have Republicans that are willing to cut the amount of spending, which is a big if, then that's the only way that you're ever going to rein it in that way. That's why I came up with my creative proposal.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of that is, too, the debt goes up because people are like, what's in it for me to vote yes on this bill? So you give to get.
Yeah.
And so you're giving something that isn't yours, the taxpayer dollar, to other people so that you can get them to give you their taxpayer dollars.
And so Trump this week has been meeting over and over with the senators, GOP senators anyway, trying to convince them that it's time to get rid of the filibuster. And his big argument is not just, oh, it'll help us get things done. That's the argument of every president. It'll help me get things done if you get rid of the filibuster. And the senators usually say, no, I've been in the minority. I don't want to get rid of it because then it takes away all power from the minority. But that's the argument that he's making to them. That's one of them. But the other big argument that he's making is that the minute they get power, they're going to get rid of it. So why wouldn't you just go ahead and do it now so that we can get things passed ahead of time before they do it? And if you don't believe him, producer Brad has been a gumshoe about this and looked up what Democrats have been saying in recent history. Here's AOC in 2022.
I believe that President Biden should entertain expansion of the Supreme Court. I believe that he should forcefully come out in ending the filibuster of the United States Senate. I believe that he should call on Congress to repeal the Hyde Amendment. And I also believe that Congress, we have the possibility when we are strengthened by the repeal of the filibuster or even the change to a talking filibuster or a standing filibuster. In doing so, we can codify Roe, we can codify, and all of the other cases that the Supreme Court indicated that they would threaten. We can codify same-sex marriage, we can codify the right to contraception, we can codify interracial marriage, we can do it. But we can only do it. We can only do it if we're not fighting with one hand tied behind our back, let alone two. And so I think that right now, we just need a fight. We need a fight. And we need to show and demonstrate to the American people that then when they vote to give Democrats power, we will use it to the fullest extent possible to defend everybody's civil, economic, and human rights.
Well, she just said it pretty plainly there. I mean, you don't get much more plain than what she's saying. She not only says that they should end the filibuster, but what they would do with the filibuster ended. And they almost did it at the moment she was speaking about it. She's in the House.
Yeah.
So she's not in the Senate, although we'll see what happens in a couple cycles.
It's important to note that the reason that they didn't do it was because of two Democratic senators, Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. And Joe Manchin, both of which are not in the Senate any longer.
Yeah. So they will do this. Mm-hmm. It's not just AOC either. But she does say a lot of what they would do, they'd codify Roe versus Wade, same-sex marriage, which is already legal, but it was done through the Supreme Court. So she's saying they'd do it through Congress and make it an actual law. That's what judicial activism looks like, is when they basically make up laws like they did with that one. But Roe versus Wade, now these are the things, and I don't think Republicans would touch same-sex marriage at this point, but I do think that the Roe versus Wade would be really a pendulum mm-hmm. you'd watch swing back and forth. If Republicans were in charge, they'd repeal it. If Democrats were in charge, they'd put it back. Mm-hmm. It would just go back and forth and back and forth over and over and over
again. Yeah, but once it was repealed, the Democrats would do whatever they want, and then putting it back doesn't undo what was done during the Democrats' repeal.
I agree. I'm just saying that's what would happen, is you'd have a lot of things like this that would become law under Democrats, and they would become not law or a different law under Republicans mm-hmm. over and over. And that's an argument against repealing the filibuster, is that the pendulum swing, if you think it's pretty wide now, I mean, all of what you're experiencing with the extremes in America, it would become law.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is very true.
Well, and the whole idea of the filibuster is that it's the saucer that cools the tea. you don't get wild swings like what you're saying, but you also have to come together and find common ground on issues. And I think the reason the filibuster is such a roadblock anymore is because as a country, we're so divided on political issues.
There's no common ground.
There's not a lot of middle ground whatsoever.
No. So nothing gets done. And so they go, well, then we have to get something done. Should we get rid of the filibuster? That's where Trump's at right now. If you think it's just AOC that's saying this, though, it's not. It was basically the whole Senate. It was, what was their 51 senators, Democrat senators at the time. And so two of them, Manchin and Sinema, were able to sink it below 50. And so it didn't happen. But there were then 49 U.S. senators that were willing to get rid of the filibuster at that time. I mean, 49. And now with the GOP in charge and they have 53 senators, it doesn't look like they have maybe even half of that. Excuse me. So you look back and you go, well, Democrats really are willing to do this in ways that Republicans are not. You go back to Obama. So it's not just AOC. You know, this is a bunch of senators and the president of the United States in 2020 saying this.
By guaranteeing that every American citizen has equal representation in our government, including the American citizens who live in Washington, D.C. and in Puerto Rico. They're Americans. By ending some of the partisan gerrymandering, so that all voters have the power to choose their politicians, not the other way around. And if all this takes eliminating the filibuster, another Jim Crow relic, in order to secure the God-given rights of every American, then that's what we should do.
Oh, the filibuster is a Jim Crow relic. Oh, I guess then we should get rid of it under Trump, right, President Obama? I mean, that's what you said. So this is President Obama. That's in 2020, him saying that. No, that can't be right. You labeled that 2020, Brad, but I don't think that's actually 2020. That's got to be before that because he was not president in 2020.
That aired in 2020.
Did it really?
Yes.
So that was going into Biden's presidency?
Yeah.
That shocks me. Wow, he wasn't even in charge saying that. That's very recent. But he did outline what Democrats will do if they get rid of the filibuster and they get power back, which is a big question, too, is will they ever actually have both chambers and the presidency? Yeah, I mean, will they ever? Yes, they will. But how soon will they is the question. They will add states. They will add D.C. and they will add Puerto Rico, and therefore they will add senators. That's the only reason they're doing it. They would just want to add senators so that they could always control that chamber. It's a smart move. I don't know if it's good for the country, but it's a smart move to retain power. The other thing that they would do is pack the courts. But there you get to the point where you go, okay, well, what would happen when Republicans got back? Well, if they had any spine about them, which a lot of times they don't, they would also pack the court back the other direction. So you'd end up with like 200 judges on the Supreme Court after about 30 years because they'd both just keep doing it. And that's no good. You'd also have probably a whole bunch more states. Because the Republicans get in charge and go, you know what we're going to do? We're going to add American Samoa, and we're going to add Manitoba, and we're going to add whoever else yeah. is willing to come on board who would be more GOP senators. But then the problem is that's such a big swing that you don't know. If Democrats added four senators all of a sudden, Republicans aren't taking back that chamber easily for a long time.
Ever. Yeah.
And so that's what you get into when you get into this debate, and it gets really thorny. And a lot of people in our chat and listeners here were saying, no, don't do this. Even though it would solve temporary problems, it would create some pretty big long-term problems. But that's where you kind of go, well, what about if you just got rid of it for budget issues, which is where me and Brad were saying, and there's a lot of debate there. So it's a good debate. It's one that comes up pretty often. The problem is it's probably going to happen. I'll conclude on this, and we'll move on to some stuff about Chris Farley. But it's probably going to happen at some point. They probably will get rid of the filibuster, and maybe it's piece by piece because that's what it's been so far with judges and so forth, and that's been both parties. It started with Harry Reid and Democrats, but it's been both parties now. At what point does somebody actually pull that trigger or pull the blanket back or whatever you want to call it? Because the party that does could have a tremendous advantage in passing legislation that benefits that party at that moment. That's the truth. That's mm-hmm. the truth. If Republicans pass it right now and they pass voter ID and they do a bunch of stuff that sort of curtails possible fraud or they limit it to more voting day instead of voting month and voting months. You know, these things probably would benefit Republicans. Conversely, Democrats could do the opposite that would benefit Democrats. So it's who's going to do it first. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, as we started with Trump, that is his whole argument, that they're going to do it. You might as well do it now because they're going to do it.
Yeah.
Somebody's going
to
do it.
And they're not just going to do it to get some things passed that are hard to get passed. They're going to do it to pass the most extreme things that they can because they know that that will never get passed any other way.
And to retain power.
Which will lock them into power.
Yes, it absolutely will. And that's where we're at. Unfortunately, when you get this polarized, you have such limited middle ground, you get to these places where you won't negotiate with me at all. Fine, I'll just do this without you. And then it becomes like, whoa-oh. And you get into, I don't want to use the word civil war.
Well, that's how, but, I mean, whenever you get to a point where people aren't, they don't see any other way.
It's what happens.
Yeah.
This is what it looks like.
Well, that's what drove the South to secede. Like, if you go back... Lincoln wasn't
even working on anything.
He wasn't even in office yet. And they said, well, if this guy gets in, we're hosed. So we're just going to leave now. And then the Civil War.
Well, it's the Manny Fry Show. We're diving deep here on Friday.
Let's talk about Chris Farley.
We literally are talking about Chris Farley next. Are you a big fan of Wayne's World? There's been some weird old clips resurface of him explaining some things about Wayne's World. That, yes, you know, this is balance, right? We start with this one in this hour, and now we're going to go to some fun stuff. So stay here. And then, again, I mentioned Sergeant Thomas Becker. He was on Wiggins America this weekend. Fantastic interview. We're going to bring that to you at 1:30 or thereabouts. So stick around for all of that next.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, a board-certified OBGYN and menopause specialist. My new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it really takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Every week, I sit down with medical experts, cultural icons, and powerhouse women to talk about what really matters, your health, your power, and your future. We're covering hormones, identity, finances, relationships, and so much more. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Unpaused with me, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I found this clip of Chris Farley, and I'm going to try to tie it in. I'm going to come up with a reason why I'm talking about this, but ultimately I'm going to tell you ahead
of time.
You
just want to play a clip?
I just want to play it. But this weekend...
It's Friday.
Did you know that a St. Louisan is hosting Saturday Night Live?
Oh, what's her name?
Nikki Glaser.
Yes.
Yeah, she's going to host...
I didn't know she was hosting, but...
She's going to host the show. I don't think she ever has before, and I apologize to... her or whoever is listening if she has, and I just didn't know it. But I go through phases with Saturday Night Live. Well, I'll watch it quite a bit. I'm in a phase right now where I'm watching it quite a bit. Don't know why. It's not any better or worse than it ever has been. It's just I'm just in a phase where I really like sketch comedy. I like writing sketch comedy. I like doing sketch comedy. I was in a sketch comedy group for a little while and after college, and it was so fun. It was so fun. But anyway, Chris Farley... We're like close enough in age, Brad.
Oh, for sure.
You were a Wayne's World fan.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I liked, like, my favorite era of Saturday Night Live was the Chris Farley, Mike Myers.
Yeah.
You know, David Spade.
Okay.
That group.
So that's
Adam Sandler.
And Adam Sandler and Chris Farley kind of crossed over between the Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey era and the newer era of David Spade and Norm MacDonald. There was a little crossover there, but those guys and Rob Schneider's another
yes.
one, they kind of crossed with both. So there was a kind of an era there with all those guys, but there wasn't a lot between Dana Carvey and Norm MacDonald, for instance. They didn't cross paths a lot. They knew each other, but they didn't cross paths a lot. Anyway, long story is Wayne's World was awesome. I used to love that movie so much growing up that I think I probably could have quoted the whole thing at some point in my life. I don't know if I still could. Yeah. But Wayne's World 2 was also funny, but not nearly as funny. Like Anchorman. The original was amazing.
Yes.
Anchorman 2 was funny, but didn't make any sense. Yeah. It was kind of the same with Wayne's World.
Just kind of left it.
Ethan, come in here. Generational gap. He just groaned.
Yeah, I heard it. I was like, oh, talk about Wayne's World.
We got to find out if you've seen Wayne's World before we air this clip. He's 24 years old. 25. Have you ever seen Wayne's World? Take your time. It's not like you're on the radio or anything.
Hold on, I forgot my water.
I'll be right back. My throat's
no, I have not seen Wayne's World, but I have seen both the Anchormans.
So have you ever seen any of the sketches of Wayne's
World? I've seen some of the sketches.
Okay, but
yes.
You never seen the movie.
No, so I didn't know there was a movie.
Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! There's an amazing Wayne's World movie, but I wondered, it's very generational. If you had to be Gen X millennial to really soak that movie in, but anyway, there's this scene where Chris Farley's in it, and he was famous at the time, but he hadn't done a lot of movies yet. Mm-hmm. So he was on SNL, but hadn't done movies. And if you recall, it's where Wayne and Garth walk out, and they're looking for Mr. Big, the record producer.
Yeah,
and Chris Farley's standing there, and he's like a security guard. And they go, do you know where he's going next? And he's like, yeah, he's going to go up. And he mentions St. Louis here, too.
Yeah.
He's going to go through St. Louis, up to Chicago, and then over to Detroit.
Doing his Chris Farley
thing. Yeah, doing the things. And so here's that clip if you don't remember it.
He's going across the country right now to look for new acts assigned to his label. Next stop is St. Louis, and he's going to come back through Chicago on his way to Detroit.
And he moves his hand.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You know, for a security guard, he had an awful lot of information, don't you think?
All right. So that's the end of that clip. Well, if you remember, and I know you're not watching it, you're listening to it, Chris Farley, when he says Detroit, he points in one direction, and then he goes, bleh. Like he changes the complete direction that he's looking, and this resurfaced recently, and for whatever reason, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so funny. He's on Jay Leno, and Jay asked him about this. I guess it was one of his first movie appearances. And he's like, what did you think about being in Wayne's World? And this is what he said.
Coneheads, Airheads. So Wayne's World, too. Now, you were the security guy in the first one?
Yeah. Security guard.
Well, that was kind of...
That was a scary experience.
Was that your first movie?
Yeah, that was my first movie. I screwed up, too, at one point.
What'd you do?
They told me to point into the camera when I was given directions. You go through St. Louis... Back down through Chicago on your way to Detroit. And I pointed off the wrong way, and I had to, like, scoot it back into the camera frame. But they kept it. It was genius. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, that was an accident. That thing in the movie where he points in the wrong direction, and then he just moves. They were like, yeah, we're just going to leave that in the movie. I just thought that was great because how many times I've seen that. I mean, that's one of those movies I watch probably 100 times. And I had never heard little facts like that about that.
When they're at that concert and they walk, they got backstage passes and they're showing, every time I do anything, now that, in media and I get a pass to do something, I always joke, like, holding the pass up and showing everybody as I walk.
Yeah.
I did this at the NASCAR race.
You probably did it at the Trump rally, too, didn't you?
Yes.
When you had the press pass? Like,
press pass. But you got to be careful at the Trump rally because that was still the enemy of the people press.
Oh, that's right. When you guys did that. The press was not looked on kindly.
Right, and he would always point to the box of where the press was, and he'd be like, there it is. Now the whole crowd would look at you and go, boo! So I'm up there like,
No, we're cool.
I got the hat on, see?
Well, anyway, there you go. If you're a fan of Wayne's World, now you know that was a accidental scene that made it into the movie. We're going to take a short break and come right back with Sergeant Thomas Becker. We are going into Veterans Day week. And so on Tuesday, we're actually not going to be here for the show. We're going to be out in Edwardsville in the Veterans Day Parade. We invite you to come out to that. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Veterans Day on Tuesday. So we'll be there. We hope to see you there. But in the meantime, I did this interview with Sergeant Thomas Becker last weekend, and it's just great. He was in Vietnam. He has a book about it. And I encourage you to stick around and listen to this. It will move you. Be right back.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Manny Fry Show with Annie out for just one day today. She'll be back on Monday. Brad and myself and Ethan are filling in. And like he said, Brad just said, if you want to hear the plan to balance the budget, we did I come up with a very creative plan that I think could work. And I ran it by you, and lots of people called in, and that was a lot of fun. But, you know, what's the next step? I think starts here on a Friday on the Annie Fry Show here on November 7th. And then tomorrow, I think probably the White House needs to take a look at this, make it to the Oval Office. And then probably by Monday,
yeah,
states start voting. Convention of states. That's the time. I mean,
there's not a lot to debate about this. You know, I mean, you go in there and you say, hey, we're going to pay off your debt.
Mm-hmm.
You accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going to balance the budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're going to make that an amendment.
Yeah. Speaker of the House probably has to take it up by Tuesday, I would think. So it'll be an exciting weekend. We're not kidding at all. But I shouldn't kid, because we're going into a really good interview here with Sergeant Thomas Becker. So I interviewed him last week on Wiggins America on a weekend show. And we'll do so again tomorrow on Wiggins America. We did a two-part series with him, and that'll conclude tomorrow. But the first part was just a fantastic interview going into Veterans Day. And I wanted to play that back here. So here is Sergeant Thomas Becker,
I'm
author.
I'm halfway through your book now.
And now I've had a chance to finish your book, of course, which is called Sergeant Becker, A Vietnam Story, 82nd Airborne Division. You were in Vietnam. And tell us the years again.
1968 and 1969. I just missed the 68 Tet Offensive, which was the height of the war.
Okay.
In fact, my unit that I joined, my battalion had 85% casualties during the Tet Offensive.
My gosh.
They'd been there 3 months before me. So I was a replacement sergeant. They ran out of sergeants,
wow,
of course. And so when I got there, I think there were 24 men left in the company out of over 100. And two of them, when I got there, they were coming off the helicopters. Two of them were in body bags.
How did they decide that you were just a sergeant?
I went to sergeant school after AIT, Advanced Intensive Training. I volunteered for it in order to stay out of the war as long as I could. And then I went to demolition school, and then I went to airborne school. All just to stay out of the war. I didn't want any part of this.
So going into, like I said, we're talking to you going into Veterans Day here because you are a veteran, and of course I'm among many who are saying thank you for your service for this time of year, especially.
Appreciate that.
What we were talking off air. Why did you have to write the book? I mean, there's some quotes I actually could pull from here that I wanted to ask you about, but I'll ask you that first.
It's just too good a story. I just had to tell it. It's like, you know, how could someone be so lucky? You know, these kind of things don't happen to most people. And, you know, people have asked me, how were you able to do this? And it's like, I didn't have a choice. It's either do what I was supposed to do or lay down and pound the ground. I mean, those are really my only choices I had.
Well, I mean, it's a story of perseverance, not just in the war, but since the war.
Yes.
You start at the end here. I'm going to read a little bit. I hope that's okay. I'm reading your book to you. It's been 54 years since I left Vietnam. That would be, what, 56 now, right?
56 now, yes.
You wrote this 2 years ago. And then I skip ahead here. I built a heavy, thick wall in the back of my mind to conceal these troubling memories. I had terrible PTSD. When I came home, I had 3 to 5 nightmares every night for over 3 years. Then slowly they diminished.
Time heals wounds.
How about now?
Oh, much better.
How much do you think about it now?
Every day.
Do you think about any people in particular?
Michelle.
Yeah.
It just tore me up that I could not adopt her, that they wouldn't let me.
Can you tell that story a little bit just for context?
Well, I reached a very low point mentally after I'd been in the war. Oh, I think I only had 6 weeks left or so. And by that time, instead of one squad to take care of, I think by that time I had six because of the loss of sergeants. And I lost one of my best friends, and it really hurt. And then after that, this is hard.
Yeah.
I almost had my throat cut one night while I was sleeping, and I managed to, I was very fast and very, you know, very quick, and the guy trying to cut my throat was moving slowly because he was trying to be quiet and all that, so I managed to stab him instead with my knife, and I stabbed him many, many times, and it just messed me up. I was at that, I think after that, I just wanted to kill almost anybody that looked at me wrong. Just in such a terrible, terrible frame of mind. And so the captain, realizing this, sent me off to the nearest battalion base camp. Wasn't even a division, it was a battalion. I don't even know what battalion. It wasn't ours. For a 10 days of getting my head back together. And there was no psychologist or psychiatrist to help me. He just gave me 10 days off, which is really strange. That's a long time.
10 days?
10 days. I mean, you know, give you a three-day pass is one thing, but 10 days. And he didn't say why or anything, just sent me there. And I was supposed to report for a meeting every day, and that was it. The rest of the time was by myself. And I finally figured out why, but I met this in the town next to the base camp. I saw this little orphan, about 5 years old. She was half French, half Vietnamese, and she was just the sweetest, the most beautiful little angel you'd ever want to meet, you know. And I couldn't, you know, I quickly realized, since she was playing all by herself every day, I did this for 9 days in a row. Spent time with her, hours every afternoon. I spent until it was time for her to eat dinner and go to bed. You know, they rang the bell. So I couldn't understand why this little girl was always smiling and always singing and so happy when she was obviously ostracized from all the other children because she was different. You know, they had their own racial problems. And it really helped me because, you know, here I was just full of hatred. And I thought, why isn't she mad? You know, she shouldn't be happy. So I kind of, you know, I kind of had an epiphany, shall we say. And it kind of, that was what brought me back to reality. And so I owed her so much.
I want to ask you for advice. I want to ask you to speak to anybody who has ever just experienced, I mean, I don't know anybody who's experienced the kind of trauma you're talking about. So you're the best person to speak on this topic. But people have, you know, trauma of their own kinds. We throw that word around so much anymore that it's, yes, it almost doesn't mean anything. But I'm talking about real trauma. What you're saying is extreme. It's extreme soul-wrenching trauma. And it's not just that story you just told. I mean, I read the book. There's a lot more to what you did in those 2 years, especially.
Yeah.
What do you say to somebody who comes up to you and says, look, I'm looking to heal? And it may be a completely different circumstance, but they want to heal from something that's happened in their past. What do you say?
Number one, stop thinking about your own stinking self. Start thinking of helping someone else. Sounds crazy. When you help others, you help yourself. That would be the number one thing. I sign all my books, life is not much worth living without love and courage and honor. And you need all three to get through life, not just through a war. Honor is really about respect. You have to respect yourself. or nobody else is going to respect you. Courage, I mean, we need courage every day to do the things we need to do. And if you don't have any kind of love in your heart, well, you know, there's really no sense living. Love is what makes a difference. So by helping others, you get that love. And that makes everything better.
Selflessness.
Yes.
Because then you can't focus on yourself if you're focused on others or God or just not focused on yourself.
Yes. You know, it doesn't have to be anything big, just little things. You see an old lady trying to get 50-pound bag of dog food in her car at the grocery store. You know, you go over there and you help her. It doesn't have to be somebody you know. It's probably better somebody you don't know. Today, I'm driving here, and there was a lot of traffic, and some guy wanted to make a left turn across two lanes of traffic, and I could see he'd been there a while, so I stopped, and, you know, I held my hand to say, no, not yet, not yet, and then motioned him on, let him go. Little thing, made me feel good. You know, all those little, you need to do that every day.
That seems like a little thing, but letting somebody across two lanes of traffic.
But I didn't want him to get creamed by the guys who weren't stopping. Yeah. So I, you know, held my right hand up. Nope, not yet, not yet.
That's probably a great lesson for all of us, just with traffic in general.
Yes.
Because I just about lost it yesterday leaving here. But
we're always in too big a hurry, so we need to, you know, help others. You know, we're all in the same boat, so, you know, just because you're in a car you can't see the person doesn't mean they're not a good person, doesn't mean that they don't need help.
Thank you for the comments, everybody who's listening and can comment on the stream. You, of course, can always... Well, we have the text line open, 314-241-9797. I'll have to actually pull up that program so I can see your text, but it is there, 314-241-9797. If you ever want to respond to anything going on the show, really at any time, that's there. And, of course, the live stream is always happening. So thanks, everybody, for talking with us as we were playing that interview. So that was Sergeant Thomas Becker. His book is A Vietnam Story. And I interviewed him last weekend on Wiggins America, which is 7 to 8 on Saturday mornings, and then replays Sunday night, 7 to 8 also. We are going to do part 2 of that interview tomorrow. And my plan tomorrow is to ask him questions about specific stories. We got to do a couple there, but we ended up talking a little bit more broadly about healing and, you know, just PTSD and time in Vietnam in general. But there are a couple of specific stories that I want to talk about with Sergeant Becker. And we'll do that tomorrow, probably toward the end of the show, I'd say 7:45-ish, if you want to tune in and hear it for the first time tomorrow morning. It'll play back Sunday night. Again, the book is A Vietnam Story, Sergeant Thomas Becker. I'm going to play a clip here from, weird transition, John Stewart, because he's saying something that, in the transcript, so I haven't actually heard this clip. Brad pulled it, and I said, that looks like a pretty good clip. Let's talk about that. It's him talking about platforming people and, I guess, generally, how do we get along? Is that safe to say, Brad? Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go.
I've got people in my family that are to the right of Attila the Hun, and when people tell me, like, how can you platform that person on your show, I go, I platform my uncle every Thanksgiving. And by the way, I love him. He's a three-dimensional human being who has qualities that I really admire. Things about him. And we've lost that. We've lost the ability to love people because we litmus test at every point, in every single moment.
Brad, is he describing you in that clip?
I don't think so, no. When I listen to that, he describes people I know. But I have never cut anybody out of my life on a litmus test. That seems so petty. And like he was saying in that clip, he said we're three-dimensional people. He's saying that there's lots of aspects to people, and it's a lot more than what their political beliefs are, what their religious beliefs are, what all these other things are. One of the things that I always try to remember and I always try to keep in my mind is it doesn't matter who this person is. They're created in the image of God and therefore worthy of my respect. And so I don't cut people out of my life, especially family members, you know, it seems like such a low place to be. And really, in all honesty, it's an immoral stance to take, is if this person disagrees with me, you are not taking the moral high ground by cutting them out of your life. You are not teaching them a lesson other than you are spiteful, little, and angry. You're not teaching them any lesson that you're trying to get them to get.
There's a difference between disliking somebody and hating
for sure.
them. Because there are people in this world that I dislike, you know, and just choose not to hang out with much because I just don't like them. And that usually has nothing to do with politics.
Right.
I just don't like being around them. I mean, just somebody who's like super, super negative all the time.
Yeah.
They're harder to be around than people who are not. And that's like deep stuff. I'm not trying to make that political. I'm just saying. But it's when you cut people out of your life for their ideologies, just because you have a different ideology, mm-hmm. that's when it becomes pretty problematic. And it causes this polarization in a way that we're seeing in the country where you do end up saying, well, that person's pretty much like Hitler. And you're like, no,
well, hold on, I don't think so.
Yeah. You know, calm down. I don't think that that person you're talking about is like Hitler, partially because I don't think you've studied World War II enough to be making that phrase. But second, the things that you're referring to, you're just sort of, it's like they're leading with, and I'm talking not any certain side of the aisle, although the Hitler thing certainly is the left does that more. But when you say that, it's as if you're leading with an emotion mm-hmm. and you're trying to find some sort of fact to put behind it, and you're finding pretty bad facts to do.
Right. Well, and the other side of that thing is, too, it's like if that's how you feel with somebody who disagrees with you, if you feel like you are being like personally attacked because they disagree with your political stance, your cultural stance, whatever it is, you have too far internalized that stance. You've made that stance too much of your identity. Like, I'm a Republican is not a core part of my identity. I'm a Democrat shouldn't be a core part of your identity. That is what you believe politically. That is not part of who you are.
Well, that's why we refer a lot of times that very reason. Is why when we refer to the left as having a religion,
mm-hmm.
because that is that identity.
It gets into that.
If you are on the right politically and your religion is the right, that's also a problem.
That is a huge problem.
If your religion is something that is temporal at all, that ends up being a problem for you. It causes these kind of things. And the other problem is once you acknowledge it, like let's say that you are somebody who is on the left or right and who's listening to Jon Stewart say that. Or you're listening to this program right now, and you hear that, and you go, yeah, I acknowledge that that's a problem. You typically don't really know how to solve it, because you have to change your whole core of who you are to solve that issue, and that is not easy to do.
Yeah, to me, the way that you do it is to look at this person that you are having so much problem with, like the real person that is going to be at your Thanksgiving table, and realize who they are and who they've always been as you were growing up. You know,
Thanksgiving is going to save America.
It has to.
That's the kind of thing we really do need, is people to sit down with people they disagree with and just listen and then walk away, possibly still vehemently disagreeing and still acknowledging that you love the person or at least care mm-hmm. about their well-being enough to not run away and villainize them. There is one time I can think in my entire life that somebody's political views became such an issue for me that I really couldn't be around them much. I didn't hate them. I just couldn't do it. And it's because I had a roommate. And it was before I was married. It was a guy who I still love to this day, but I don't see him a whole lot. And he was this is my era of the George W. Bush administration. I was just out of college. And he was my roommate. And he hated George W. Bush so bad that it was like he lived and breathed it. And I was pretty young, so I wasn't really good at arguing politics yet. I don't think I was bad at it, but I wasn't as polished as now, having done this for, well, in certain parts of radio for 20 years, but this part of radio for 7. And he would want to, I'd come home from work or whatever, and I was working at TV at the time. It wasn't political or anything. I'd come home from work, and that dude would be ready to argue me in politics.
Oh, man.
And I was like, dude, I appreciate the argument. And I would say this sometimes. I'm like, I understand that you want to argue and debate. And I think debate generally is very good. I also am very tired. Just give me a break, man. And he just couldn't figure out those boundaries. So ultimately, yeah. It was not so much about the politics as about the boundaries that he was crossing that I just personally couldn't quite reconcile with him.
Man, it sounds like he just had a lot of frustration and needed some place to put that frustration, and you were the living embodiment of the Bush administration in his life.
That was tough. That was tough. It was a tough place to be because you're home at that point. It was not a sanctuary.
But, you know, and the other side of that is, and to our point in the conversation, he's the one that drove you away, and it wasn't because of anything other than he couldn't put away his feelings about the administration.
Well, that's the way I like to think about it. I don't know whether I was perfect in that. I probably got mad at him a few times over politics, you know. I don't know that I was flawless, but I also know that I did not hate him. I know that for sure, and mm-hmm. I still don't. But that's the only time I can come up with that I ever was like, maybe that did get in the way of our relationship. But I truly try not to do that. Anyway, this is the end of the second hour. We got a lot coming up. Ethan Sports and Local, of course, will be next. And then What Did I Miss in the last hour of the Manny Fry Show.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.